welcome to week two of our time with How to Be an Anti-Racist. Let's start with a deep breath. Closing your eyes if we're in a space where it's safe to do so, and inhaling slowly. And exhaling slowly. Good work. Okay, today I am ready to just dive right in. I don't have a bunch of intro stuff for you today, so let's dive right into this week's reading, which is chapters 2, 3, and 4. Chapter 2 is called Dueling Consciousness. And in this chapter, Ibram makes the case for the idea that many of us, probably most of us, have some level of dueling consciousness when it comes to race. So in simpler terms, we simultaneously believe in two conflicting ideas at the same time. And in my view, if done with self-awareness and open-heartedness and humility, this isn't such a bad thing, believing in two conflicting ideas at the same time. Carl Jung called the paradox one of our most valued spiritual possessions and a great witness to the truth. He wrote that only the paradox comes anywhere near to comprehending the fullness of life. I like that quote. So I'm 100% on board with sort of that kind of dueling consciousness, right? It's the only way for me that like the big existential questions of life make any sense to me. That being said, in this book, we're not talking about spirituality. We're talking about the cold, hard realities of racism in the United States today. So let's see if we can dissect what Ibram is saying here. So he spends the chapter introducing and fleshing out three different definitions of an assimilationist, a segregationist, and an anti-racist. And to summarize these, a segregationist is someone who believes that there are superior and inferior racial groups and that these distinctions are fixed. So you're born into a better or worse race. A segregationist supports policy that keeps racial groups segregated, and Ibram argues that white people tend to have the consciousness of segregation in us. And this is not an unfamiliar idea for those of us who are coming right off of white supremacy, of white fragility, because Robin DiAngelo talked a lot about how, you know, white people, we carry all kinds of white supremacist beliefs in our psyches. And even if we believe that we're good, right people, white people, definitely not racist people. So we're well positioned to come off that book, to read this book, to take in this idea. And another thing that Robin discussed in White Fragility is how white people generally tend to live lives in which we're mostly segregated from other races. Not all the time. That's not cut and dry. But it's probably true for more white people than we realize. And then there's the fact that if we're honest with ourselves, we probably also carry in our minds some rather unpleasant ideas about people of color and what they're capable of. So this is all uncomfortable, that's for sure, but there it is, a segregationist. Then we have an assimilationist, who is someone who believes that certain racial groups are culturally or behaviorally inferior, and they support enrichment programs to develop the inferior groups. So for example, a teacher with assimilationist beliefs may encourage her Black students to act more white in order to be successful. And she may encourage that overtly. She may actually say those words. In this day and age, probably it would happen much more subtly, but that would be the underlying message. And so Ibram argues that the second consciousness that white people tend to carry is the assimilationist consciousness. So that means the dueling consciousnesses that are sort of battling with each other in most white people, according to Ibram, is segregationist and assimilationist. So, quick pause. How does this land for you? Looking at yourself and your own psyche, do you think that you carry both segregationist and assimilationist beliefs? For me, I would say yes. Abram's analysis feels spot on. And I think I'm able to admit this because I've done the foundational work of reading and really spending time with white fragility. I mean, this is just the way I've done it. So it is what it is. But I also really feel like white fragility it's such a great starting place for white people starting to do this work. It sets such a foundation. And then from there, like once you've really gone into your own psyche, oh, then at least for me, I feel much more able to look at, read these other books and be like, oh yeah, no problem. I can see my segregationist. I can see my assimilationist. It's all there. And then finally, we have an anti-racist who believes that racial groups are equal and none needs developing. And anti-racists, of course, support policy that reduces racial inequity. So Ibram says that Black people's dueling consciousness usually tends to be a mix of assimilationist and anti-racist beliefs. At one point in the chapter, he refers to, quote, an inner strife between Black pride and a yearning to be white, that he has, I think he was referring to that, exists within him. So he continues to tell us the story of his parents' evolution. We know from chapter one that a core part of their How We Met story is that they both were at Urbana 70, which was a conference focused on Black liberation. But over the years, their thinking evolved as they graduated from college, got jobs, white-collar jobs, and they entered the new Black middle class. And their thought process was influenced as part of that class by government policy, key word there, that had started the war on drugs, quote-unquote war on drugs, under Nixon. And that planted and then heavily pushed a narrative of Black on Black crime. So we can start to see why Ibram is so focused on policy as the biggest driver of racism or anti-racism, because policy is what caused Ibram's parents to cultivate an ethos of Black self-reliance, and with that to turn their attention towards other Black people and why some other Black people were the problem, which meant, conveniently, that they weren't paying as much attention to the greater systemic forces that were working behind the scenes. And, you know, so he could see, not that this is only his personal belief because it's what happened in his family, but it happened in his family. What happened in his family was a reflection of what was happening in the greater consciousness. At least, that's my understanding. So this has me thinking about how generally, Americans are trained to think through the lens of personal responsibility a lot. We hold that as a value instead of policy. And this way of thinking is so ingrained in us that it's very possible that we've never actually looked at it in the light of day. And when we start to look at it in the light of day, things get really interesting. Like for me, over the years, as I used to be a wellness teacher, and I used to teach personal responsibility very much so when it came to teaching my students about healthy eating. And I don't think that is a bad thing. Let's learn about how some foods offer more nutrition than other foods. But to teach that in like by itself without also presenting the consciousness of let's look at how policy has made unhealthy foods much cheaper and more accessible than healthy foods and how that has affected different socioeconomic groups. My school that I used to work at, there were a lot of kids who about 50% free and reduced lunch, which is a standard indicator of poverty. And I think back on how I used to teach about healthy eating through the lens of personal responsibility when 50% of my students came from families who were living in poverty. And then you start to look at the policy behind why that was and the policy behind food and how everything comes together. And I cringe a little bit. I'm like, oh, Annette, like that was harmful. That was harmful to put shame on people who are in this system where systemic poverty, systemic racism have caused them to make it really hard to like be like, oh, I should eat more apples and spinach. Like that's apples and spinach is very expensive compared to McDonald's, right? So it just, it's not that, again, it's not that like the facts of healthy eating shouldn't be presented, at least not in the way I think about it right now. But now I realize that to present it only through that light without looking at the policy, looking at that and really like examining that within my own consciousness so that the way I speak about it is more respectful and less shame inducing. And then teaching that lens to my students so that they could also have the awareness to look critically at these systems and not just think, you know, not just go home and shame their parents because they're like, hey, my wellness teacher said I should eat more fruit. Why don't we buy more fruit? Why don't we have more fruit at home? And then put their parents in the position of having to maybe think or explain or feel ashamed that fruit is too expensive for the family budget. You know, like, ugh, it's messy. So we're going to have a call to action about kind of getting curious about our own thoughts and places where we have looked at personal responsibility and for totally forgotten to look at policy and the effect of that as well, because it plays a role in racism and in a lot of other things and a lot of the inequities, probably all of the inequities that exist in our society. Okay, so one other small piece that I wanted to comment on from this chapter is how in the same paragraph, Ibram discusses, quote, America's undeniable history of anti-racist progress and, quote, America's undeniable history of racist progress. And both stories are true at the same time, which to me makes sense because people with dueling consciousnesses will produce a dueling reality. And Ibram doesn't spell this out for us, but after reading this chapter, my thought is that hopefully over time, now that more and more people are waking up to racism, more and more people can practice anti-racism more often, right? As they kind of learn the context and develop the skills, as we do, as I do, which will result in more anti-racist policies, which will result in a society that is solidly moving in the direction of anti-racist progress without simultaneously moving backwards at the same time. So hopefully we can resolve this dueling consciousness, have the anti-racist consciousness take over as like the main mainstream consciousness. And from there, it's very exciting to think about how we can move forward in that direction, right? Like I've been thinking a lot about how cynicism is the enemy. Cynicism is the enemy of progress. Cynicism is the enemy of hope. And Ibram says that, I think, in the introduction or chapter one. We can't let ourselves get cynical and believe that racism is a problem that cannot be overcome. And that's just like sinking in for me more and more. Just this own real, like, oh, like I can have my cynical moments, but this awareness that I really want to be careful and guard against that because cynicism is also lazy. If I'm cynical, I don't have to do anything. So anyway, I digress. Let's talk about chapter three, which is called Power. And there's a lot going on in this chapter, like there is in all the chapters in this book. So I don't know about you, but for me, Ibram's writing style, I find it a little hard to follow because he goes back and forth between different vignettes, like story about his childhood, and then he talks about history, and then he talks about policy, and then he kind of keeps intertwining, going back and forth. And he's very smart, obviously. So he goes back and forth through all these things in order to make his point, all of which relates to the main point of the chapter. And he doesn't coddle us as he does. And so I'm finding that I have to really pay attention as I read, even more than I usually do. And then at the end of each chapter, I spend some time asking myself, okay, so what were his main points here? I don't pressure myself to be like, okay, you have to like understand and be able to like coherently repeat every nuance. But if I can read the chapter and spend a little time thinking about his main points and then write them down in my notes in this for this audio and then explain them verbally or kind of review them, well, then that is enough of a process for me to have a valuable takeaway, right? Even if I don't get every little thing. So I found this to be helpful because I mentioned that I've read this book before, but I didn't absorb much. And I think that's because I wasn't taking the extra time to think through what he's saying. And as we know, it's one thing to read a book and an entirely different thing to actually get something out of it and integrate what we learn so that we show up differently in our lives. And we are here for the latter. Okay, so back to power. I distilled Ibram's main idea here into a simple flowchart to make it more understandable for me. And hopefully I have it generally right. But as always, don't take my word as gospel. Please don't take my word as gospel. Do your own analysis. Come to your own conclusions. You are always welcome to find me blatantly wrong. But since I'm the one talking into the microphone right now, since you have me in your ear, let me tell you about my flowchart. So it basically starts with self-interest / desire for power, which leads to racist policies, which leads to the concept of race and the inferiority of certain races so that those in power could justify their racist policies. Basically, at the end of the day, it all boils down to greed. So let's talk a little more about Prince Henry the Navigator. I found this story incredibly interesting. So the gist is that Prince Henry the Navigator was the brother and then uncle of Portuguese kings in the 15th century, and he is the first character in the history of racist power. So at that point in time, slavery already existed. Slavery has existed for a very long time, right? But at that point in time, the slave traders were Islamic, and they enslaved Africans, Arabs, and Europeans alike. So Prince Henry the Navigator wanted to circumvent the Islamic slave traders, and so he sponsored Atlantic voyages to West Africa. And just the reason he went there is just because it allowed him to go around the general routes of the Islamic slave traders. And he wanted to be able to find a way to cut out the middleman and get the slaves directly, because then that's much more lucrative, right? So this turned out to be successful, which resulted in the Portuguese beginning to exclusively trade in African bodies. So instead of needing to buy slaves from the Islamic slave traders, they were kidnapping and then selling their own slaves, all of whom happened to be African because of the route they took to avoid the Islamic slave traders. And this turned into quite a lucrative venture. Ibram writes that, quote, "A traveler observed in 1466 that the king was accumulating more capital from selling enslaved Africans to foreigners than from all the taxes levied on the entire kingdom." So this, the slave trade, the African slave trade, became more than half of Portugal's entire economy, which, like, once they started doing that, why, from just a financial perspective, not taking ethics or morality into this at all, but just, oh, if greed is your main value, well, then of course you're going to keep doing that. So then, of course, but they had to justify that what they were doing. So the king asked his royal chronicler to do so. And his royal chronicler did, by constructing the idea of race and racial hierarchy together. Those two ideas were developed at the exact same time. And then, of course, in the hierarchy, African people were rated as inferior, which was apparently enough of a justification for everybody to sleep at night. So if you remember, Robin in White Fragility talked about how Thomas Jefferson did something similar in the early days of the United States in the 1700s. He needed a reason to justify slavery. So he asked scientists to do studies on why Black people were inferior. Not if they were, but why they were. And of course, the way you phrase the question has a whole lot to do with the answer that eventually emerges. So, can you imagine? I mean, Can you imagine being the royal chronicler? I guess he was just a yes man, and yes, men and women still exist today very much. They're loyal to who they're loyal to. And even if they can clearly see what's happening in front of them is morally unjust, or maybe they don't. Maybe they're just so blind. I mean, just so like they've been so brainwashed into their perspective, they can't see it. I mean, that's quite a thing that this guy came up with, the Royal Chronicler. Let me just make up this idea of race and that there's different races and some are better than others. It boggles my mind. It absolutely boggles my mind that that was the beginning of racism. And yeah, whoa. And it reminds me of what Ta-Nehisi Coates says, which is he wrote in Between the World and Me. Race is the child of racism, not the father. And I've heard this a few times, but learning this history, really starting to get, oh, okay, I see that now. Now that I know that this is how it all started, okay, race is the child of racism, not the father. Wow. Wow. It makes me, a friend was telling me that Ibram's other book, Stamped from the Beginning, really is a history book, and it's about the history of the slave trade. And it makes me really want to read that book. Not because I'm like delighted to learn about this horrible history of kidnapping and enslaving people, but just because it's so interesting, right? And I know that my mind has I received a whitewashed version of history throughout my entire education. So it feels like the other side of the story needs to be filled in. And I feel very hungry to fill that in. And then go from there. So, okay, let's talk about chapter 4, which is called Biology. And the main idea of this chapter is that race does not biologically exist. This is not just an idea that Ibram is putting forth. This is a scientific fact proved by the Human Genome Project, which found that all humans, regardless of race, are more than 99.9% the same. That being said, because of racism, we must recognize race. Because if we don't recognize it, there's no way to measure inequity and therefore no way to dismantle racism. So as Ibram writes, race is a mirage, but one that humanity has organized itself around in very real ways. So it turns out to be a bit of a catch-22. I'm reminded of Buddhist teacher Tara Brach's teaching that sometimes things are real but not true. Race is real, but not true, right? It's real because it affects our everyday realities, the way that I experience the world as the races that I am. It's very different than the way that a Black person experiences the world. It's real, but it's not true. It doesn't biologically exist. But many people believe that it does, which led Ibram to develop the term biological racist, which is one who is expressing the idea that the races are meaningfully different in their biology and that these differences create a hierarchy of value. So Ibram shares his own journey with this and how he used to accept the idea that the races are biologically different. But at the same time, he rejected the idea of a biological race hierarchy. And he says now that holding these two ideas at the same time was like accepting water and rejecting its wetness. Because, as we learned in the last chapter, they were invented at the same time. The hierarchy was invented at the same time as the idea of race in order to justify greed. So let's pause here. Let's do a little self-check. Breath. And just ask ourselves, do I believe now or have I believed in the past that there are biological differences between the races? And for me, the answer is yes, like without a doubt, yes, which means that I am a biological racist. Okay, that just is, and it makes sense because it's my conditioning. It's what I've been hearing my whole life. And now that I know this, I can bring awareness to it whenever it comes up. Whenever I find myself having a thought about how the races are biologically different from each other, I can do my best to recognize it and name it as biological racism. I can be like, oh, there's that thought. That's my conditioning towards biological racism. And for now, that's all I need to do. I don't need to try to change it. I just need to bring awareness to it. And then change will happen by itself. We bring awareness to things, like awareness is a catalyst for change. So there's no need to like turn it into this big, big, huge thing, right? All we need to do, be mindful, do our studies, have the ability to pause in the midst of our day-to-day lives and watch our thoughts and observe them and name, like bring awareness to the ones that are problematic, name them. That's it. Awareness is a catalyst for change. I'm not saying that's the extent of our anti-racist work, but I think it's the first step. Okay, so other main points from this chapter are that while there's no such thing as racial ancestry, like we have been led to believe, ethnic ancestry does exist. So Ibram quotes bioethics scholar Dorothy Roberts, who says that people are born with ancestry that comes from their parents, but are assigned a race. So for me, my ancestors are from China on my mom's side, and from Germany, the Netherlands, and what was formerly Bohemia, now the Czech Republic, on my dad's side. That has nothing to do with race. That's my ancestry based on the places in the world that my ancestors came from. So Ibram then brings us back to the categories of the assimilationist, the segregationist, and the anti-racist that he introduced in chapter 2. And he says that when it comes to biological race, the segregationist believes that there are 6 different biological races. The assimilationist believes that there is just one race, and that if we would all just stop talking about race, racism would go away. And then meanwhile, the anti-racist both recognizes that there's no such thing as biological race and that there are living, breathing realities that come with the racial mirage that must be recognized and reckoned with. So there's the holding of the paradox. Here's where the holding paradoxes are one of our most valued spiritual possessions comes into play. Okay, let's talk about calls to action. My first suggestion is to continue to develop a definition of the kind of person you want to be. 2, make a list of things that you believe that people are generally personally responsible for. And then go through the list, and for each one, ask yourself, how does policy play a role in this? So you might think people are responsible for their diet, for how much they exercise, for their educational outcomes, for their career paths, etc. And it's just, you know, an exercise and looking at those things, whatever is up and in your mind, and just thinking about policy. What if I took on the lens that policy plays a role in this? How does it play a role in it? What if I looked at that instead of at personal responsibility? Interesting kind of opening, perhaps, to turning our eyes. Like it's like our heads are stuck and we've been forced to only look in this one way. So we only see this one view of personal responsibility. And this exercise can possibly just like, allow us. It's like in The Wizard of Oz when they put some oil on the Tin Man and he can start to move. Like this is like the oil that starts us in moving so that we can move our neck a little bit and we can look at it through a different lens, see a different view through this idea of policy. And then my third call to action suggestion for you today is to choose one to two parts of this week's reading that you found the most interesting and tell someone else about them. So, thank you for listening. As always, I am so grateful that you're here. I will talk to you again next week. Mwah! Bye.